Welcome to another edition of Expanding Mind. I'm your host, Eric Davis. And today we're going to dive into Zen Buddhism, American Zen Buddhism. When I first got interested in Buddhism, I was in India. And this American Tibetan monk named Michael Roach gave me a book by Tsongkhapa, and it kind of blew my mind. And when I got back to New York City, I decided to start studying Buddhism, and Michael Roach happened to be in New York, and he was kind of known because he had gotten the traditional Geshe degree in Gelugpa Tibetan Buddhism, which is kind of like getting a PhD. So he'd done his homework. And it was really odd because just a few weeks ago, as some of you probably know, there was a very peculiar scandal surrounding Michael Roach, who was a very straight, Buddhist monk, very kind of ordinary, very by-the-book guy when I met him. And then at some point in the late 90s, he got all tantric and weird, and his hair got long, and he started to kind of change the message a little bit, and some people think he's a heretic, and blah, 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 and he developed this weird relationship with this woman that was supposed to be platonic, but there was clearly some kind of tantric thing going on, et cetera, et cetera. And then recently there was this whole bizarre death associated with this three-year retreat that he was hosting in some godforsaken part of Arizona. And so it was a sort of an odd flashback. But at the time, back in the 1990s, you know, I found the Buddhist philosophy I was reading in this Tibetan class very interesting, but I was really not into the meditation because it had a lot of stuff in it. You were supposed to think about this and then think about that and then visualize this and remember this and go through the four what-sits and whatever, and that was just not where my head is at. So I found my way to a little zendo just off of Washington Square that was run by a woman who taught media at NYU, really beautiful teachers, continues to do teaching today, Inkyo. And so I really liked that because basically they would just leave you alone. You know, it was like, here's your mat, here's the wall, go at it, kid. And that was a style I kind of liked, but, you know, I'm not really a joiner and the whole religion thing, and I love the aesthetics like of a lot of Americans. You know, you see Zen, and it just gives you this kind of nice, clean, crisp exotica that's not too over the top, and yet it has this sort of nice aesthetic vibe, minimalism. And so, you know, I kind of liked the vibe, but I was still just not really sure about how far I was going to go in and start doing meditation retreats and get a teacher and that whole kind of thing. And one of the things that tripped my mind was when I met our guest today, the American Zen failure, David Chadwick. And we met, I think, outside of Santa Fe in the late 90s, friend of a friend, blah, blah, blah. And this guy was just the biggest character I'd met. And we spent the whole night not talking about Zen, but talking about alien channelers, and this character named Bashar, and it was hilarious. It was wonderful. It was just the flavor of like fascination and insight coupled with the down to earth, grounded humor that is just, you know, one of my favorite spiritual flavors, and that is part of Zen in a way. And so I'm very happy that we'll be talking to David today about all his doings. He's kind of like the king archivist for Shunryo Suzuki, who's, you know, probably the most influential Japanese Zen teacher to come to America and really help kickstart American Zen, at least in a sort of mass way that went on to really, you know, influence American culture in general. So I'm sure we're going to have a great conversation. But before that, we'll bring on our co-host here to Expanding Mind, Maja Dawu, White Witch of L.A. How are you doing?
I'm good, Eric. How are you?
I'm very good. Have you ever sat, like, zazen in a zendo?
Oh, dude. Zen is really difficult for me because I like to do stuff. Like a lot of my favorite meditations, you do stuff. So
right.
Zen is hard. But yeah, you know, a lot of people don't know that Zen Buddhism is very closely related to martial arts and yoga because the yogi that kind of they say maybe Zen came from, although there's a lot of debate, was of course Bodhidharma or Da Mo, who's the one that started the Shaolin Kung Fu, and he was an Indian yoga. Some people say maybe he was Chinese. Nobody really knows. But it all kind of comes from the same place. But Zen was just that style of, you know, eradication and all the Zen stuff. And he supposedly, you know, stared through a wall with laser beams coming out of his eyes and got out of jail. But
yeah, he brought qi, too. So we got all people, all lovers of qi and other pharmacological supporters must, you know, praise Bodhidharma for all that. Yeah, my whole meditation improved greatly when I realized that the physical posture that you were taking, there's a lot of emphasis on the physical posture.
Yeah.
And did I realize that it really is just like a yoga position, just a yoga position that you're just holding, you know, as you go through all of the difficulties of not moving. And,
totally.
You know, it really does, even in the way it's practiced, there's a kind of yoga dimension of it. But it is hard. And I remember the great French theorist, Michel Foucault, you know, the one that all your theory head friends quote, and, you know, the whole bald-headed guy, you know, Order of Things, Madness and Civilization. He went to Japan in, I think, later, you know, in the 70s, and he sat Zen, Zazen. He, you know, I don't remember if it was for a week or a few days or even a day or whatever, and then so then someone came to him. It's like, oh, you know, Mr. Foucault, what did you think about Zen? And he said, it's very hard.
Yeah.
So, so you're not alone there. But let's bring on David Chadwick. David, welcome to the program.
Oh, hi there. How's it going?
Very good. So we're actually not that far apart. I'm in Houston right now, and you're visiting, as they say, in Fort Worth, right?
Right, right.
I'm Which is where you're from?
My mother, who's listening to this in the den.
Wonderful. Are you from Texas?
Yeah, I'm from Fort Worth.
One way we could just launch right into it is just like your own personal origin story. What drew you from Texas back in the day to California and your encounter with Shinryo Suzuki, this amazing, amazing figure?
Okay. Let me try to make this brief. I was raised in a home, and I interview a lot of people, you know, so I have a really unusual background in that the sort of spiritual teaching I was raised on was very compatible with Buddhism. I'd call it mind-only Christianity. There's New Thought Christianity, sort of out of Emerson, Thoreau, where anything that's written in the Bible and stuff, it has to do with states of mind, not historical things and about beings and all that. And that is true in mystical Christianity, too. So anyway, with that as a background, I did some civil rights work and was with SDS a while, and then, you know, started smoking pot and lived in Mexico for a year and took acid. And then I had this one acid trip that made me think, I should meditate. This is not, you know, there's something incredible and marvelous at the center of everything that you can experience. pardon me, just getting over a cold here. You can experience by taking psychedelics, but you're not going to stay there that way. So I thought, I'm going to go find a guru. And so I thought I'd look around in California, and if that didn't work, I'd go to India. And I was just getting ready to go to India, and I thought, oh, I haven't checked out the San Francisco Zen Center. And I knew about it because I'd bought some grass at somebody that lived across the street. So I went there, and I met Katagiri first, Dainin Katagiri, who we called Sensei then, who was Suzuki's assistant. And, you know, he gave me Zazen instruction, and I started sitting there. I thought, okay, this is good. I'll try this for a year. And then Suzuki returned from Japan, and I liked him. And you know, I became a company man for 10 years. And, you know, was ordained as a priest by him before he died. And then I stayed with Richard Baker for another 5 years, 5 years with Suzuki, 5 years with Baker. And then I sort of went freelance. But I always stayed close to Richard Baker, Zen Center, and I'm an alumni. So that's it.
So, what was it that kept you going? I mean, you were like one of the first waves that people went to the Tassajara Monastery up in the middle of nowhere.
Oh, yeah.
And helped kind of make all that happen. And,
yeah.
You know, it's like, from my perspective, it's always interesting, like, there's something about those early years that, not to get all nostalgic, but there's a quality there that I think, you know, in some ways, it was sort of harder to maintain as things get institutionalized. It's an old story, everybody knows it, blah, blah, blah. But it's always good to kind of hear a little bit of, you know, particularly since there were so many heads, you know, in the 60s who were, you know, in San Francisco, hey, there's this, you know, Zen Japanese guy who's sitting in the morning, let's check it out, you know, and people are checking out everything, and it's this whole heady time, but then it really worked for some people, and it really, like, clicked.
Right.
In this really interesting way, and I'd love to hear a little more about how you characterize that.
How I'd characterize why I stayed?
Yeah, or just the vibe. You know, what was appealing about it at that time, or what was it that was drawing people that they were discovering there that they weren't discovering elsewhere that gave it that particular quality?
Well, I'd say one thing I liked about it, I'd call a low reading on the cult meter. You know, right away you weren't encouraged to stay, you weren't encouraged to believe anything. You just got together and meditate with people. They hardly told you anything about meditation. Suzuki was always very low and category two on telling you anything, really. You had to figure it out or, you know, ask. So it was comfortable. There wasn't a great deal of socializing afterwards or anything. People were pretty much on their own. This was before there was any residential practice before Tassajara. Pardon. But not long after I came, we started a fundraiser that led it to us buying Tassajara. And then I was down there a couple of months later. I was, you know, living in the woods. And I look back on that now, and I think, wow, was I lucky.
Yeah.
You know? But I think life is mysterious and magical, and I don't think anything is really luck, but I don't know how it works, you know.
What was Tassajara like for people who don't know about it? I mean, it was kind of an extraordinary, I mean, still an extraordinary place, but, I mean, the whole way it comes to be, the how remote it is. It's very remote.
It's Tassajara Springs is in Monterey County in Los Padres National Forest at the end of a 14-mile dirt road that's about 3 miles off the Carmel Valley Road, about 11 miles into wilderness, or, you know, into the countryside, I'd say, from Carmel Valley. So there you've got 28 miles away from the nearest town. There is Jamesburg that's at the end of the dirt road, which, you know, has, I don't know how many people, 50, 100 people around there. The road into Tassajara is, you know, it's frightening. It goes up to 5,000 feet and then descends back down to 1,500. And Tassajara is the oldest, is a very old hot springs resort in that area that was used by Indians before that. Robinson Jeffers wrote a poem where he mentioned it, some Indian hands on caves. So it had a very devoted group of guests who went there in the summer. So we took it over and kept running the guest season. And I was put in charge of the dining room right away. And I ran the dining room the first 4 years. And I always dealt with guests when I was there because I was, you know, talkative and outgoing. And a lot of people who get into Zen are more quiet and introspective.
Well, I wonder, I know you said there wasn't a lot of social interaction, but in a place like that where there's basically a bunch of people getting together to do meditation, was there any crazy stuff that kind of happened on a group level, like weird synchronicities as you guys were meditating, or was it all pretty much, did you feel like it was contained within the individual, or did it like leak out into the hive mind kind of?
Well, I think anytime you meditate with other people, there is a boost, you know. But that would just be, you know, different depending on the circumstances and the people. And also, like I mentioned, it was very low on the cult meter. There wasn't a lot of talk about stuff like that. You know, people would just come meditate, and they'd tend to be pretty quiet, say hello, and leave. It is great meditating with other people. I'm going to go sit with there's a very small little ragtag Zen sitting on Thursday evenings in Fort Worth, and I'm going to go sit with it this evening. I like to do that. It's nice to sit with other people, but you can sit anywhere. You can. You don't have to sit. You know, when you think about Zen, you know, most of us have heard or read or met Zen through some particular group, person, or teacher, and we think that's Zen, you know. But Zen is just a word that comes from jhana, which means meditation, and it's the sort of direct insight school that hit China from Bodhidharma, who incidentally was from India. He was from Tamil Nadu in southern India, where I spent 4 months last year, living near the Ramana Ashram, and which I love. I love Advaita Vedanta, the, you know, non-dual Vedanta. You know, things like what is happening when a group sits, you know, it's very hard to say, but I think most people recognize it's good. It's hard to know what you're imagining, though, and what's real.
But was that one of the appeals of Zen, or at least Suzuki Zen, back in the day, was that there was so much kind of sort of fuzzy thinking and drugginess and occultism and astrology and this and that, and that there was something kind of crisp and cutting through about a certain way with that emphasizes so much practice over the kind of ideas or concepts or all these kind of dialogues, where it's almost the opposite. It's like a flip. It's like what we're doing here is practicing, not talking so much.
Right. I think you're right. There was, you know, there was so much, like you say, there was a lot of crazy thinking going on. There was a lot of experimental thinking. People were breaking loose from the way they'd been programmed, and were looking into different ways of viewing the world, viewing existence and the cosmos. And, you know, there was a lot of weird paranoid stuff, but there was a lot of weird non-paranoid stuff, and there was, you know, all sorts of different things. There was great stuff happening, you know, a lot of very interesting communes, and there were communes where everybody had hepatitis from shooting up speed, and all sorts of things happening. And but at Zen Center, you came, and it was sort of, it wasn't, you know, I didn't care about any of that. Suzuki Roshi had a way of neither affirming or denying anything, you know. Like there were people on various food trips, and he wouldn't say one thing was right and another thing was wrong. He'd say, "Oh well, we should eat what we're served," and you know, of course, grass and acid and all that were a really big trip. He would not fundamentally. He wouldn't put down grass and acid. He'd just say he didn't know anything about it, and please don't get high when you come here. But he knew he was getting a lot of students because of people's experiences on what is these days referred to as entheogens. You know, I remember he was asked by somebody, he said, "Oh yeah, some professors and all his students are coming to class high. What does Suzuki do about it?" He said, I don't do anything about it. They just come to sit here, and then they forget about it.
Well, how much of, especially now, I mean, you've done so much work on Suzuki. You wrote this great biography, Crooked Cucumber, and you're keeping these archives, and there's, you know, a lot of material, and there's a lot of people who keep sort of the legacy alive, but you really have devoted a lot of your time, you know, over more recent years to that. When you reflect on the, like, quality of at least the Zen Center, the center that Suzuki started and that, you know, grew up around Northern California and then went on and influenced a lot of other, you know, currents and trends in America, how much of that is really about his particular personality. You know, how much it was he brought a certain stamp that made it work in that situation in a way that maybe the next guy wouldn't have. And versus how much of it was just like the culture was ready for Zen. Zen was going to come in, and there's something about that practice and something about the Japanese flavoring of or Soto Zen's flavoring of the Chan, you know, meditation practice that was ready to hit, or really whether it was something about him in particular.
Huh. Well, I think all of what you said makes sense. I think some of it had to do with who he was, and at the times, of course, and the people who came. You know, there's an old saying, Buddha was great because people were great. You know, that's really hard to say. I'd say Richard Baker had a lot to do with it, too, because Suzuki needed Richard Baker and other students who were very talented helping to form a community and an organization around it that would help preserve the practice.
Right.
Zen Center is a pretty strong institution. This is the 50th anniversary of the incorporation of Zen Center. Suzuki came 53 years ago, and 50 years ago this August, Zen Center was incorporated. So they must have some PR person or something, because I read it, like New York Times, Huffington Post, and I get calls about it. And I had to write something for the Shambhala Sun. I think I had the last email on today. Very brief on Zen Center history. They have a long article by Colleen Bush, who wrote Fire Monks, on Zen Center history. And, you know, people call me up and they ask me, what do you think of the Zen Center now? Or what do you think Suzuki Roshi would think of the Zen Center now? What would he say about it? I'd say he wouldn't say anything about it. Just like an ex-president, you know, tries not to interfere with the government. But, you know, I think he'd be pleased. And, you know, institutions can only be so good. They're always irritating and screwing things up. So I think Zen Center does pretty good. And they one great thing about it is they have so many different teachers and different things happening. Like on the Huffington Post, there was this blogger said, oh, it's full of, you know, scandals. And I said, right. Yeah, the last major scandal was like, what, 30 years ago or something. I said, you know, you've always got scandals with people. It's a pretty tame outfit. Yeah, I read in something somebody wrote, you know, that everybody takes drugs. No, not true. People gravitate towards saying things like that. But it wouldn't even matter if it were true, because people do, you know, people like to indulge. So,
well, that's the thing. People take drugs, and they're part of institutions. Like, people take drugs everywhere. So it's always ridiculous when people try to make that affiliation with the organization. I mean, how, for you, are you able to kind of separate your identity from the organization, or do you find, like, you get enmeshed in it?
No, I don't. And I don't even get enmeshed in Suzuki. You know, I've worked on, like Eric said, I've worked on the biography is called Crooked Cucumber, The Life and Zen Teaching of Shunyu Suzuki. I've worked on that, on the oral history surrounding him and his students, on preserving his lectures for 20 years. But I don't really think about it. And I just do it. It's something that keeps me out of trouble. And in terms of identity is one way to look at what the very core of what spiritual practice is about. So there's only one true identity, I think, that we all have, and that we're, you know, searching for that, and I think that's what spiritual practice is about.
Well, I think you're pretty exceptional in that regard, because it's very difficult for people. Like, they'll join these organizations, they'll have a guru, you know, I mean, it's the whole guru-itis thing, where someone gets a guru, gives them spiritual teachings, and then they can identify themselves with the guru or their spirituality with the guru, and they don't quite make it past that other level, you know? I mean, was there something you feel like you were able to accomplish that you didn't fall into that, or is that just like kind of go along with the whole Zen thing? Like,
well,
like,
yeah, but Zen isn't as, you know, Zen emphasizes the importance of the teacher, but it's not a It's not as guru-centric as, say, Tibetan culture. The whole culture is guru-centric. And in India, a lot of the Hindu practices are very guru-centric. And, you know, devotion and concentration are one of the universal methods of waking up. So I'm not against that. Even if one is really focused on their guru, what the guru really means, again, is absolute identity. It's not a being. It's not, it has nothing to do with any particular person. That's just sort of the catalyst. That's the thing that points you toward it. All spiritual teaching is just pointing towards something, and none of it is actually true. That Buddha said, you know, at the end of his life, he said, oh, I've lived so many years and taught so many years and never spoke a true word. Everything is just like trying to get us to wake up. And whatever it is that's trying to get us to wake up is not the point. You know, the old oft-repeated example of, practice, the teacher is like the finger pointing to the moon. So the moon so represents awakening. Say. So you're supposed to look at the moon and not the finger. And in the Bible, early on, very important thing it says is not to worship graven images. And, of course, that means not to believe what you think and not to get caught up in teachers or beings or books. The head of a big Baptist group said he thought it was interesting, all these people clamoring to have the Ten Commandments put in front of some courthouse. He said he thought it was interesting that they were worshiping graven images, a graven image that said, don't worship graven images. really, it gets down to you have to let go of everything. Sort of everything in spiritual practice is sort of like you might say it like you have all these different robes on. So this one robe helps you get into the next room, but to go further, you've got to take that off. You've got to drop it.
Well, here's a question for you. When you left, you know, after 10 years, you know, you've been 5 years with Baker Roshi, I'm sure there are lots of things going on, and it could have been earlier, it could have been later, but just, you know, almost like on the spiritual level, what was it that was like, hey, it's time to drop this thing too now? Is it just a kind of impulse, or was it like a crisis, or was it a thought-out process? Because that's something I think a lot of people deal with, is they get in something, they're learning, it's a working structure, and then it's kind of a pain, but they're going to still have it, there's family relationships, all this stuff is happening inside of being in a group, and then, you know, at some point, for different reasons, people kind of break, and it's how that can be a step towards liberation rather than being seen as like, you know, falling away or like losing your commitment or whatever. So I just because you're also such freewheeling guy in the best senses of the term, what was it that was like, okay, I think it's time for me to leave?
Well, there were some specific events that happened. I was running the grocery store, the Green Gulch Green Grocery. I'd been living at Tassajara for 5 years. I was at Tassajara for 5 years. Then I was at the city for a year. I was at Green Gulch Farm for a year. Then I went back to Tassajara for 2 years. Before that, I'd been in the city for a year. I was having my wife didn't want to be with me anymore, and she wanted to date other guys, and she wanted to work. She wanted to stop taking care of the kid. And Baker Roshi and I were arguing about the business. You know, it just sort of got into a bad place, and I thought, I should leave. So I talked to him, and I said, you know, I should really leave. And I said, I need to so I can develop my own strength. But, I continued being close, and I came back and was maitre d' of Green's restaurant and helped start a recycling center. And I lived at Green Gulch 15 years later for 2 years, and at the city center for a year. But so I've continued a relationship. But the last time I lived there was 87. I lived there all of 87. I really think you know, each person's got their own individual path, and for some people, maybe it's good just to stay with an organization. It's sort of like a university. Like some people will say, in a sense, stay, be professors, right? But basically, most of us need to move on. And the something like the Zen Center or some spiritual practice like that, it's usually an opportunity you have when you're younger to have a period of concentration. It's good to take advantage of it and then apply that in your life, the rest of your life. You can meditate anywhere, and you don't have to be sitting in any particular posture. I mean, Full Lotus is great. I can't do it anymore. I don't trust my knee. But I sit Half Lotus, and I sit every way. I sit all sorts of things. I sit in chairs. I meditate when I'm walking. You can always meditate, you know.
Hey, so we got to take a break right now. If you're listening to Expanding Mind with Eric Davidson Majadeh, we're talking with David Chadwick, and we'll be right back.
Welcome back to Expanding Mind on the Progressive Radio Network. This is Majadeh, and we're here with Eric Davis and David Chadwick, and we're talking about Zen and the practices therein. And I was wondering, David, if you could kind of talk a little bit about what it is you're doing when you meditate. Because a lot of people say the word meditation, like, you know, you'll hear that a bazillion times. But I think there's a lot of people don't really understand maybe what that word means. Like, what is it you're doing? And I know, like, Zen, for example, is a particular type of meditation. There's lots of different kinds, and we had mentioned earlier in the show that, it, you know, it's hard. But can you just, in kind of a nutshell, say maybe, like, what happens in your mind that is meditating as opposed to just, like, your regular being? Like you mentioned, you meditate when you walk. You can meditate anywhere. So what, is there, like, a switch that you turn on and now you're meditating and then you're not? Or, like, what is the difference between when you meditate and when you're just kind of cruising around?
Yeah, that's a good question. That's an important question. There is not, I would say, there is not one type of Zen meditation. Bodhidharma did, who was, I think it's been pretty well proven, was a real character, came from India. And there was Zen in China, incidentally, at that time. I know a couple of my closest friends are scholars there, Bill Porter, who's Red Pine, and Andy Ferguson, who wrote Zen's Chinese Heritage. And they go over there and do China tours and discover all sorts of stuff about it. But anyway, Bodhidharma's type of meditation was what they call wall gazing, which was sitting and facing a wall. And but what he was doing at that point, say he could have been following his breath. Probably he was sort of beyond that. A good way to meditate is to follow your breath or to count your breath, and those are both very universal. And counting can be like counting from 1 to 10 on the exhalations, then going back, or it can be even 1 to 3, or it can be counting inhalations and exhalations. You can have what they call just sitting, shikantaza, which is just sitting there and seeing what happens. There's a really great Advaita teacher named Muji, M-O-O-J-I. You can Google him and see some of his YouTube videos. He's from Jamaica. And he said, well, don't call it meditation. Just stop. Just have a period where you stop. You're not, you know, you're not creating anything. You're not doing anything. You just see what happens. And he says awakening will happen in when you do this naturally. You don't have to do anything. You just stop doing things, right? He said, just like you put some food on a table and it starts rotting after a while. I didn't do anything. It just starts to rot. I think that just sitting is it's fine, but it's you know, a lot of Zen people use koans, which are meditation questions, something to concentrate on that, you know, might help you break through to the fundamental misunderstanding of what's happening. I personally like the Ramana Maharshi's Who Am I, which also is one of the fundamental koans. And that's from a very old, from early Hinduism. I don't know how old Who Am I is. And Ramana Maharshi said to continue to ask, who am I, it will in itself, your mind will wake up. There's the practice of saying thank you, which is Hindu, Buddhist. Meister Eckhart said there's, if your only prayer is to say thank you, that's good. So there's, you know, the main thing about meditation is find out what meditation is. And what works for you. There's an old thing about meditating on a blue vase. So you can think of it as concentrating, or you can think of it as just not producing, not doing anything. Suzuki Roshi used to say, we sit, let thoughts come and go. We just don't serve them tea.
So when you're meditating, like throughout all your experience, is there one thing you do, or do you do all kinds of different ones? Or is there something like that you just kind of go back to over and over?
Well, these days I concentrate on who am I and thank you.
Mm.
I've found that to be very effective. It depends. What type of mind, you know, I think people really have to find, in a sense, your own mind will guide you. You have to follow what your, sort of like your higher consciousness, it's the indications it's giving you of which way to go. I've always called that following the green lights. Like, by that I mean, you know, like you have red light means stop, yellow light means caution, green light means go. And that's intuition, you know. It's hard to say. It's pretty obvious that when you look at all the spiritual teachings that have been throughout the world, that there's no one thing that works. I was just writing I just started a little thing on my website, cuke.com, cuke.com, today called Mind Seeking, Way Seeking Mind. And the reason is because my agent thinks maybe I should do a new book, and I don't want to. I love putting stuff on the website, but maybe I might get some money if I do a book. Because I live on donations, because of the archiving. I just wrote a little thing today about be yourself, and it was just a beginning of what I'd say about it. And that is also a fundamental teaching of that sort of like who am I? The idea of just being yourself, and you know, what does that mean? I mean, Ramana Maharshi said that when you ask who am I, that the self that you have a sense of being is, you know, is real. You can feel it's real, but you're misinterpreting it, and that what it is really is the absolute.
Mm.
And so if you just keep asking who am I, you find out who you really are. But it's also obviously very difficult to wake up. I mean, some people do, but we don't know who. It's very hard to judge other people's understanding. And also, it's really a waste of time.
You know, it's funny, too, with meditation, where there's such an emphasis, especially when people start out, and especially when they have other desires and needs going when they're exploring their spirituality, to kind of emphasize some kind of method. You know, and then the method becomes like this, you know, thing that they hold on to when it seems like, and, you know, maybe this just reflects my own pragmatic kind of anarchist you know, very American perspective, but that, you know, ultimately at some point, it's really about your own particular singular journey through this space. I mean, just in meditation, not journey with the big kind of metaphor of your whole life and all that kind of stuff. I mean, it's like people who go to, like in yoga, right? So American yoga. So you got all these different yogis, whatever. And, you know, the really, you know, the strong ones, the creative ones, the people who generate followings, who change teachings, who develop students. Well, what are they doing? They're inheriting something, and then they're creatively exploring in their own experience, modifying, and then kind of coming to their own thing, which then they start presenting or teaching, and then they get students, and the students kind of ape that for a while. But ultimately, what you're aping from your teacher is not something that you can just copy. It's your own development of your own singular, plunging into your own, you know, singular way without necessarily knowing exactly where you're going beyond maybe the green light and the red light of intuition.
Right,
although,
right.
Although even those guys are sometimes a little screwy.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think that's all right. And, you know, we, America, we are very eclectic. Like Japanese tend to, if they start something, they stick with it, you know, and they have a very low opinion of dabbling around in different things. And I think one thing we have to be careful about is trying to, you know, do too many things. Richard Baker once called it eating around the edge of the pie. You know, you just want to eat the crust all the way around. Don't want to get into the center. But at the same time, I mean, everything you got to beware of to become, you know, just totally, to become a true believer in some particular formula, you know, I think that's not going to work.
So I'll just be, you know, we're winding here, and there's a couple things I definitely want to get in. One is, I should have asked this earlier, just a little, you know, again, you spent a lot of time with Suzuki, and for good reasons. I mean, I think that, you know, Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind is the great work of American Buddhism as a text, as a literary text. It's the first thing up. And there's other great ones as well. But just there's something incredibly powerful about that, partly because, you know, he also had help in its writing, and it's an interesting kind of like Japanese-American fusion. It's a very powerful text. And
well, he didn't write anything. Those are just lectures he gave.
Right, but they were. But my understanding was that they were to some degree edited.
Read. I have all of Suzuki Roshi's lectures. You can read the original, unedited versions of all but two of the lectures in Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind by going to shunyusuzuki.com. I have every Suzuki lecture there. I have all the audio, all the video. I have 500 photographs. And you can look at the chapter in Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind and see what he actually said. It's amazingly close.
Wow, that's great.
Those lectures, he knew it was... I wrote a whole thing on it. There's the 40th anniversary issue of Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind. I put an afterword in it. And if you go to zmbm.net, which I started for that, you can read the afterword. You can also read the annotated afterword. And it'll tell you... You know, one of the things that'll get it, I got into was how this was he knew it was going into a book, and it's like he really nailed it. You know, it's a very strong group of lectures that needed very little editing, and that's not always true of his lectures. A lot of them he just sort of rambles around, and what do I do with this?
Yeah, that's sort of what I was thinking, just because I had read other things, and they're, you know, they're great, they're inspiring, but just there was something particularly special about those. But I just wanted to give you like a chance also just to give us a little sense of like what he was like personally. I mean, like, is there a story that you remember or you like to tell people? I'm sure people ask you this, but like some encounter you had with him that really stuck in your mind as kind of at least representing the way you related to him, or just the particular quality he had as a person. Because I find him very, at once, extremely inspiring and elusive. There's something, you know, there's that representation of him at the City Center in San Francisco, where there's this wonderful, I can't remember the artist's name, but this sort of, there's just a shadow of him, and it's his diminutive shadow in this one stairwell. And it was serious, something
that
like
that. That might be Robert Quagliata, I'm not sure.
Yeah,
might be Rob
Gove. So what's your sense of that shadow or that body?
Well, he was quiet. He was small. In interviewing people, I'll tell you the things that come through. The people that knew him, they say they felt affirmed by him. Now they'll say he's the only person that ever understood me, and he would give people the sense of accepting them. That was rather overwhelming, and he had a sort of presence that most people picked up on that made them feel good about themselves. This is not necessarily true of a spiritual teacher or a Zen teacher. This was just the way he was, and it isn't necessarily true of him in his prior life in Japan. I think something happened to him when he came to America, but you know, he preferred not to, some representative examples of, like once at Tassajara, I was working with him in the garden, and I asked him some question, you know, like, you know, I've been with him for 4 years, and I'm still, like, going, you know, like some eager student, you know, oh, Suzuki Roshi, tell me, do you think blah, blah, and blah, blah, or whatever? And he said, well, let's take a break, and he made some tea, and he said, you know, I'd rather not talk about anything. he said, I'd rather just work and sit zazen. He said, I'd rather not even give lectures. He said, there's really no need for any of that. then the opening story in my first book, Thank You and Okay, An American Zen Failure in Japan, it's like the, what do you call them, epigraph?
Yeah.
I'm driving him to the city. This is a little earlier from Tassajara, and we stopped at the early Thunderbird restaurant, which is a little hole in the ground in Carmel Valley, and he drank like 3 cups of coffee. I remember he got in the car, and I'm driving, and I'm saying, oh, Suzuki Roshi, you know, I really want to be a good student. I really want to understand life. I want to understand Zen. And I'll just do whatever it is you tell me to do. And I went on like that, right? Just tell me what it is to do, and I'll do it, and blah, blah, blah. And I wait for an answer, and I look over, and he's sleeping.
That's so Zen.
So also, tell me a little bit about the archive. I mean, I know you're kind of doing like a campaign run on it. You keep on working on it. You're really devoted to it. But how's that going? It's kind of hard, right? You got to like get some support and everybody's distracted. And
I never have enough money. I'd like some money now to give. There's a woman who's just a super transcriber. She's a Zen priest. She did a lot of work for me for Crooked Cucumber. And there's a guy who's been working on the audio. See, I've got volunteers who help me, and I still can't get things done. And he has improved the audio on some lectures that weren't transcribed before. So there's like 20 new lectures, and I've found some others. And so, you know, I want those transcripts. They take time because they're hard to hear. And then there's some interviews I did, and she's doing that. So I have like a backlog with some of the interviews. And I've got a really massive oral history. I don't just interview the sort of in crowd or the best students. I'll interview anybody. If somebody was dropping something by a Zen Center and had some impression, I'll interview them. But it has to have to be people that were there in the Suzuki era. So I've got the oral history and working on the lectures and presenting the lectures. Zen Center does it too. And I work with the guy who puts them up on the Zen Center site. And I've got a page. If you go to the homepage of kuke.com, there's a little link to do it. It means what I'm doing. And there's donate. And it's, you know, it explains enough. And I always work on that stuff, but I don't really stress about it. I'd love to get more done.
what keeps calling you forward? I mean, archive work is a particular kind of, you know, laborious, slow-moving, lots of moving parts, lots of kind of tedious organizing and making determinations and editing and working on this kind of stuff. You know, obviously it's compelling you, but, you know, in some ways I could say, well, like, but isn't it kind of not zen? I mean, isn't it sort of more zen to just be like, that was then, now I'm now, you know? And I'm not saying you're not being zen about it. I'm just saying, like, what is it you think that, that continues to compel you year after year?
Oh, well, I think I have an overdeveloped sense of completion, which is just probably, it must be one of the basic delusions, you know, that in terms of the lectures, I really, there's just so much work I like to do. Like all the audio this guy is working on to make them all sound better, right? And, you know, I'm trying to get him new audio software. And just to get it, although these aren't particularly good lectures to listen to, I think the best thing is just to listen to him talk for a few minutes, get the idea, and then read it. And also, I'd like to do a light edited version of all, say, 300 or so lectures. Got about 80 of them done, and those were done by a guy in Norway. They're really good. And just working on presenting it better. And, you know, people frequently ask me, well, why didn't the Zen Center do this? Well, the Zen Center has done a lot, but they tend to do sort of, people there tend to do particular things, like take a group of lectures and work on something. And I'm trying to do something that's overall. And they ask me, why didn't the Zen Center give you money? Well, I'd rather do this as a gift to Zen Center, and then you don't have to worry about control and all that, you know? I do other things. You know, I write about other things. Actually, everything I do, if you just go to kuke.com, my main website, I sort of tell what's happening in my life.
Oh, yeah,
what I'm working
on. You got a lot of stuff going on. And then here's another kind of maybe obvious question, but still.
Let me say one thing about kuke.com and archiving. My agent and good friend says that this is really a unique event in a sense, in that you're seeing a life work here that usually in the past you'd wait until the historian or whatever was, you know, like dead or something, and they'd publish, you know, some set of books or something. But because of the internet and the way things are today, you're actually able to participate in the process. And there's completed things like Crooked Cucumber and Zen Is Right Here, which is a little book of vignettes on Suzuki. And there's all sorts of stuff on the website. I mean, there's over 5,000 files, not including images. And some of them are like 100 pages long.
Wow.
But, you know, not all of it's Zen. I've spent time on political, social. I always put stuff about the war on drugs, which I think is a great crime, and torture. I put stuff about torture, but I try to stay away from social political things because other people are doing that, and nobody, you know, not many people are working on the Suzuki Roshi material.
Well, just a couple of minutes left, so it's got to be a quick one, even though it's obviously not a quick answer. But I'm curious what you think about the future of Zen, qua Zen, in America, in the sense that, you know, like a lot of things happened in the 50s and 60s and 70s. A lot of forms came into America, a lot of gurus and teachings and currents and traditions and practices and things like that. And now we're in this such a weird world of interconnecting and neuroscience and self-help and everything sort of melting into everything else. Do you see something, does it seem like it's going to keep on being able to replicate itself as a tradition, as a specific form, or do you think it's going to more just sort of dissolve into this kind of spiritual stew, and does it matter?
Yeah, well, you know, I wonder all the same stuff. The fundamental essence of all religion is right in front of us, and I think Zen has helped to clarify some things, and Advaita has, and mystical Christianity, and various things. And I think the self-help thing has been fine. Understanding the fundamental nature of existence is is not the same as improving yourself. But anyway, I don't know. We'll see. I sort of tend to think things will evolve into new forms that we can't imagine.
Wonderful. Well, we're just going to have to end it there. David, thanks so much for joining us on Expanding Mind.
Hey, great to talk with you. You take care.
Okay, so David Chadwick, Cuke.com, C-U-K-E.com. And from all of us here at PRN, Expanding Mind, keep your minds open.